Please be seated. In memory of great sacrifices, in hope of great justice, I stand today in memory of those who have made great sacrifices. One of the reasons I agreed to speak this Sunday is because of this weekend, when we remember those who have made grave sacrifices for our country. And I perceived being asked as an honor, since I am a retired armed force person, to speak this weekend on the title or subject of Memory of Great Sacrifices and Hope for Great Justice. I stand today as the living embodiment of the hopes and dreams of many who made great sacrifices. The significant gains in the civil rights movement were won by people and not by process. They were won against incredible odds and often at great risk and sacrifice. Thousands of activities in modern freedom struggle were victories won in the march and the call for civil rights. We are approaching the 50th anniversary of the March on Selma. And believe it or not, 50 years later, we're still marching. And we still need to march on the Selmas that are around us. It was those sacrifices and the people who made them that made our being here today possible. These individuals were involved in an unfolding drama that always comes when people seek great justice. Historically speaking, it was at Mount Zion Baptist Church in Albany, Georgia, where an a cappella singing group first sung the song that became the trademark of the unifying forces of the civil rights movement and has been used ever since for most any movement in which we seek social justice. Ruth Harris, Bernice Johnson, and Cordell Reagan had no idea how famous their a cappella words would become when they stood there and sang, "Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. Turn me around, turn me around. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. I'm gonna keep on walking, Lord, marching up to the freedom land." That song has become the anthem of every group and every people who have sought social justice in any form or fashion since then. But this morning, I not only stand in memory of great sacrifices, but this morning I stand on the shoulders of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in particular. It was on April of 1957 in Montgomery, Alabama, where he delivered a sermon entitled, "The Birth of a New Nation." In his opening, and I quote, he said, "I want to preach this morning from the subject, the birth of a new nation. And I would like to use as a basis for our thinking together a story that has long since been stenciled on the mental sheets of succeeding generations. It is the story of the Exodus, the story of the flight of the Hebrew people from bondage in Egypt through the wilderness." We have been doing quite a bit of talking in this congregation lately about transformation. We've been talking about the fact that this place is a place of transformation. It's a place where transformation takes on three aspects: transformation of the self, transformation of the community, and then transformation of society and the world. As a congregation, we have chosen to build and to transform by way of doing social justice work in the community. This morning, I too, like Dr. King, would like to spend a few moments with you thinking about what it means for us as individuals, as a congregation, and as part of a society. In the Exodus story of the oppressed people of Egypt, the story really begins long before Moses goes to Pharaoh, or the people begin to leave. The story begins many, many years prior to that, when Moses leaves Egypt as a fugitive and spends time in Midian and in doing what I would like to call this morning his own personal transformation. In other words, Moses had to spend some time in personal transformation before he could become the leader of a community as he led them through the experience and the process of communal transformation. Anybody can't do that. As each of us look at transformation of self, our personal transformation, like Moses' personal transformation, is not about what others say about us or what others do to us. It's not about how we've been rejected. It's not about our despair. It's not about our disappointments or our failures or the failures of others. Our personal transformation is not something that is external to us, but rather about transforming that which is resident in the self, in us, that thing that dictates who we are and why we do what we do. That's what needs to be transformed. All of the world's religions, whether you know it or not, seek to help us master that. It's called the ego. All of the world's religions seek to have us subject the ego within each of us to the virtues of justice and mercy. And folks, this ain't easy. It requires work, hard work, if we are going to transform self so that self can transform community, in order for community to transform society. Justice itself is a concept that is based on the principle of equality and fairness. Justice is believed to have been achieved when something is morally and ethically right. The transforming of self is subjecting the ego, your pride, your "I'm so great and it's all about me" attitude, to looking at and trying and striving to achieve in your being and in your living that which is morally ethical and right. As members of a community, each of us has the duty to reach out to help others facilitate their transformation. And transformation, as in the Exodus story, does not happen overnight. It takes time. In the Exodus story, it took 40 years. But I would hope that we are not quite that rebellious or that stubborn. My personal experience here is that we're not. We're not perfect, but we're not far from it either. We're right there. We just need to walk through the door. And be not mistaken. Sometimes wilderness wandering is necessary. I'll say that again. Wilderness wandering is necessary. Wilderness wandering prepares one for triumphant living. The Exodus story teaches us that. Because if we are faithful, we shall overcome. We shall be the people we want to be. We shall be the institution that we are proud to own. Wilderness wandering leads to excellence. We've already began to take on the task of feeding the hungry, giving drink to the thirsty, inviting the stranger in, and clothing those in need of clothing. We visit the sick among us and provide assistance where assistance is needed. The New Testament admonition of Matthew 5:25 has fallen on both hearing and deaf ears in this congregation. And we have become a people who live its admonition. We have stood on the side of love in the areas of marriage equality, immigration, the right to earn living wage, and for the civil liberties and equal protections of all persons. And all of these we have framed as our social justice work. We have been attempting to assist those who were experiencing a justice deficit. We've been attempting to close the gap between a social excess and a justice deficit. We've been seeking to close that gap and to bridge it. And we can do that work, but we must remember that we must do the work on self first. And even in doing the work, we may not see the results. Dr. King, I will never forget his final sermon, which said, "I have been to the mountaintop. I've seen the promised land. And I might not get there with you, but I can tell you we as a people will get there one day." We have to do our work in that spirit, in the spirit of knowing that we are working for justice and equality that even we may not see. And the type of social justice work we have been doing, when you look at the literature, is but one type of social justice work. There are several types of social justice work spoken of in the literature. One of them is called distributive social justice work, which is what we do. The other is restorative social justice work, which we have done on the fringes. And I think it's very important for us to clearly understand the difference in these in order to be effective in doing them. Since we do distributive so much, I will talk about that later and just briefly tell you about restorative social justice work. This is the type of social justice work that has as a component fairness that is required for both the oppressor and the oppressed and the community. This type of social justice work is the type of social justice work we do most often when we deal with the justice system. Because what we are really asking for in those situations is mercy. So often we look at mercy as being something different than justice, when in fact it really is not. Justice itself should and must always be tempered with mercy. Justice in its purest form requires fairness. It requires that one receive their just due. And when we're dealing with situations where people are sometimes the due is a bit unjust, what we're looking for in those situations is not justice, but some mercy that will come close to closing that gap, that space, so that there is a level playing field. Restorative justice is concerned with both the offender, the offended, and the community. And it requires that all parties be present at the table and that all parties be represented. And it's important to understand when we're doing this type of work, because when you understand that this is the type of social justice work you're doing, you understand what is required. It's a lot different from doing distributive social justice work. In distributive social justice work, it is concerned with the nature of a social just allocation of goods in society. The concept includes available quantities of goods, the process by which goods are distributed, and also what is the resulting allocation of goods of this society accomplishing. We often look at that and think that we're doing good social justice work, and in most cases we are. But the question sometimes we fail to answer or fail to realize is that while we are doing social justice work, are we really looking for pure justice, or are we looking for a quantitative justice that comes about sometimes when mercy is invoked? We have partnered with some organizations, and unfortunately, or fortunately, we have partnered with organizations that require that we understand both. Because we have partnered with organizations where if justice in its rawest sense were to be distributed, we could not, and they could not, achieve their goal. When someone who has an addiction relapses, do we just rush in with raw justice? Or does that justice have to be tempered with mercy? When someone falls or stumbles because they haven't grown to be able to conquer their demons, do we rush in with raw justice? Or do we look for some mercy to be present? I say, when we ask that someone be given a second chance, or that someone be given a third chance, we're looking for some mercy. We're not looking for raw justice. And so, because of the nature of the institutions we're partnered with, it is very important for us to understand that while we do the distributive part, we also have to be aware of and cognizant of the restorative aspect of that social justice work. Because it is a work that is attempting, in many cases, to habilitate, and in a few cases, to rehabilitate. And that kind of work takes mercy, something we all need. And in your personal transformation, if you really find that you don't need mercy, you've got a problem. All of us need it. We need to be treated fairly, yes. But we also need a little mercy when we make a mistake or when we don't quite measure up. You can't have one without the other. Distributive justice has some norms, and I will run through them quickly. Equity, which means the outcome is based on what the individual invests. Equity distributive justice says that he who gives the most gets the most. Then there is equality, which says, regardless of one's input, everybody gets the same thing out of the pot. If you put in 60%, You get part, you get it, and you get just what the person who put in 20% gets. That's equality. There is distributive power justice, which says those who are in authority and who have status gets more than those who do not. Then there is distributive need justice, which says people get what they get based on how much they need. And most of us will understand this that are parents, because we usually do that as parents. We give each child based on that child's needs, because we love them all the same. The final one is responsibility. And it says that those who have the most should share their resources with those who have less. So as I stand before you this morning in memory of great sacrifices, I also stand in hope of great justice, because I believe beyond shadow of doubt that justice will always roll down like water. And that's because I've come to understand and to know at the core of my being that the arc of the universe, no matter how long, bends towards justice. And I've been around a while. And as long as there's Judaism with its ethnic responsibility and ethics responsibility, justice will roll. As long as Catholicism has its reverence for life and the dignity of the human person, justice will roll. As long as mainstream Christianity has its "I'm my brother's keeper" and it's my job to care for those who can't care for themselves, justice will roll. As long as there is Hinduism with its equality of all beings and all of existence, justice will roll. As long as there is Islam with its covenant and its governance of social justice, justice will roll. As long as there is Buddhism with its alleviation of suffering, justice will roll. Great justice triumphs can take residence in the hope of all of us. And I don't know about you, but I can tell you, I believe justice, great justice, will come. As long as I live, and either after I'm gone, because I realize now something my grandmother used to say. She used to say, as long as I believe. And I can tell you this morning that as long as I believe, justice shall roll down like waters, and righteousness as a mighty stream. And we can be part and parcel of it if we live true to that which we claim to be our mission, that of transformation, of first the self, then the community, and then society. Amen. So mote it be.